Hi, I'm Umushu.
And I'm Lindsay Claiborne, and you're listening to Beyond the Microscope. Hey everyone, our next guest is Emily Calandrelli. She is the host and producer of Fox's Exploration Outer Space. It's an educational program for students 13 and up. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what is this show you're talking about here? What do you do? What does being a host and producer of this show mean?
Yes. So Exploration Outer Space is an educational nationally syndicated program that airs on Fox, and it's also for free on Hulu. And it's just a show that is trying to show off the coolest and most exciting projects that are going on in the space industry today.
So what's the structure of the show?
The show in our first season, we had 13 episodes, and each episode kind of covered a very general theme, like going to Mars or journey to the moon or space tourism, these type of very general broad topics. But we show off the history of these topics, what's currently going on in these topics, and the future of what's going to go on in the space industry in this topic. So we really just kind of cover the whole gamut, and we show off the coolest people and the experts that are working on these projects in the industry today.
Do you go and search out people to interview, or do they come to you, or is how much of it is your sort of ideas that you put out there?
Yeah, no. So I have been studying in this field as an undergrad and as a graduate student for 8 years now. So I've definitely heard a lot about what's going on in the industry. And so a lot of the people that we try to get on these interviews are my idols in the industry, people that, you know, I've watched their work for years, and they're really leaders in this field. So we try to get them on this show, and we really try to show off the coolest parts about their job.
So no pressure for you, just, you know, interviewing your idols.
Yeah.
Have you ever been starstruck?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked to a lot of astronauts, like astronauts that have been around for a while and have been to space like 5 times. And, you know, I'm sitting in front of them as the interview and the interviewer, and I'm supposed to be asking them these hard-hitting questions. And I'm like, this guy in front of me has been to space 5 times. So those are times where I'm certainly starstruck and kind of nervous when I'm giving the interview.
Do you think your sort of nervous energy, because I know when I've done interviews, when you're interviewing a celebrity or somebody, you're like, oh my God, I'm sitting in front of, okay, can't, must not show any emotion, must not give it away. Do you think your enthusiasm can sort of come through on your show, or you want to, do you try to sort of show that enthusiasm to get your audience into it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think my nervousness comes out through excitement. So I have nervous excitement, and I think when I interview them, that probably shines through because they get me excited. I mean, this is a 5-time shuttle astronaut that I'm interviewing, and that is really awesome. So I think that when I'm interviewing, that certainly comes out.
So let's roll back a little bit. Were you on the other end of this? Were you ever a kid watching a show and learning something about it? How did you get yourself here now?
Yeah, so I think I grew up, as most, you know, American kids, with Bill Nye the Science Guy being a household name.
Oh, and so, man. Okay, continue.
Right? Like, he was just our science idol growing up. He made science seem fun and exciting. And, you know, that was when we were in grade school. So growing up, I think I had this idea in the back of my mind that there was a way to make science sound cool. And when I went through undergrad, that idea kind of flipped on its head, right? Because most scientists and engineers, they're not known for being the coolest people in class. They're not known for being good communicators.
That's an understatement.
And they're certainly not known.
Hey.
Right? I mean, like, they just don't have that stereotype of being like these super exciting people. But then I always had, you know, this thought in the back of my mind that there are the Bill Nyes of the world that can do this. And so I think going through graduate school, I studied technology and policy, which taught me how to communicate technology to a layman audience. And that, I think, taught me the skills to try to at least, you know, live up to some of the expectations I set for myself through watching Bill Nye.
So you went So after graduate school, how did you decide, or how did you land in this position as a producer for a Fox TV show?
Yeah, so I wish that there was a more interesting story, but really all it was I was working on a startup at the time. You know, startups are really popular at MIT and in the Cambridge area. So I was working at a startup at the time. It was going pretty terribly, and my co-founder and I were looking for jobs elsewhere. And my production studio literally emailed me, and they said, hey, we're looking for the host of our new TV show that we want to be, you know, an educational outer space show. Would you be interested in being the host?
And you said, yes, please. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I mean, well, to be honest, I ignored the email because I thought it was spam. I was like, this doesn't happen to people. And then they contacted people that I knew from grad school and people I knew from undergrad. And then my advisors were contacting me and they were like, get in touch with these people. So they stopped emailing me. And I finally, you know, I got back to them and turned out to be real. And it was definitely like my dream job.
Were you doing something like media related beforehand? Or like, did you have a blog or what? I mean, what is it that got them to find you? Or do you have no idea?
Right, exactly. So the way that they have told me, because I've asked that same question, I'm like, how did you find me? So I guess that the way that they found me was that I had done a few outreach videos at my undergrad where I was encouraging people to do engineering. Oh, okay. And I was really big into like speaking at schools and trying to get younger students excited about science and stuff. So I guess they had found me through that. But no, this was certainly not a path that I had sought out or like something that I thought I'd be doing. This was just kind of a pleasant surprise.
Do you miss the technical side, the engineering side, or do you feel like that you're doing it anyway? Because I mean, I know when you do an interview, you have to translate and that's a lot of work. I mean, do you feel like that's, you're still doing the engineering and the science?
Exactly. And I get that question all the time. And I'm also asking myself that question all of the time, because I do get to interview these people who are working on amazing projects. And sometimes I go home and I'm like, oh, I kind of wish I was working on that project. But at the same time, with my job, I get to understand and dive in to so many different types of projects every day with this job. So it's sort of a trade-off, right? Because maybe I'm not working specifically on one type of technical project, but instead I get to learn about everything that's going on in the industry, and I get to understand kind of like a bird's eye view of the space industry. So it is a trade-off, and I do miss it at times, but I think if I had to choose, I'd pick the job that I have.
Can you give us an example of what one episode would be like, the topic or the structure, and, you know, is this sort of part interview, part?
Yeah, no, exactly. So the show itself is geared toward basically an audience who is 13 and up. Our demographic last year skewed 20 to 30. And so that kind of gives you a good idea of the level of topics that we cover. But for example, we did an episode about Journey to the Moon, and we talked very briefly about the Apollo program, but then we talked about the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter and LCROSS, these two lunar missions that really told us all we know about the lunar surface. And we went to NASA Ames, and spoke to the project engineers who are working on these missions and who knew everything there was to know about LRO and LCROSS. And that was really fun because we got to really dive in deep to the way that we know everything about the moon. And then we went over to Google Lunar XPRIZE teams, and they showed us how we're going back to the moon. So you can see how we're kind of diving into the history of the moon, what we currently know about the moon, and how we're going back. One of the things we always try to do with our show is kind of look toward the future and see where we're going to be in terms of space exploration 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now. And we get to talk to the people who are doing it today.
What's the hardest part of this whole job? I mean, obviously, it sounds like you're traveling a lot. It sounds like a lot of production work. I mean, coordinating all those things is not easy. What is the hardest part and what's the best part?
Yeah, I think the hardest part is probably trying to book a lot of I talk about trying to book the idols, my idols that I'd like to interview. A lot of these people are really, really busy, obviously. And, you know, we're trying to tell their story to an audience of 500,000 people a week. And so we think that we provide value to them, but at the same time, what they're doing is incredibly important. And so the hardest part is being able to sometimes convince these people that what we're doing is worth their time, that is so valuable. And it's hard. It's not a super fun position to be in because I'm trying to be like, you know, take a couple hours out of your day to allow me to ask you questions so that I can in turn tell your story.
Yeah, we know that feeling. You know,
yeah. It's an uncomfortable position, right? Because you want to be like, I'm trying to do something good here, I think. And
trust me,
I don't want to
nice
waste
people.
Your time.
We're nice people. We won't hurt you.
We do really good work. I swear I'm a smart person. I'll ask really good questions. So that's probably the hardest part. The best part is seeing the final product. Because when we're in the field doing this, there's so much chaos. We've been working for 12 hours filming and these people are kind of annoyed with us and they're trying to kick us out and we're trying to get these last few bites that we want to put in the show. And then we have a sound engineer and we have a field producer and then we have an executive producer. And there's all these different people who are editing the same content. And then being able to see the final product and how well it's put together and how well the team has worked together to put together something that's fun and educational and looks really clean. I mean, that is something that it just seems like magic at the end.
Just wave your magic wand and there it is, right?
Yeah, done. Poof.
If only.
What's the time scale for going from sort of concept for an episode to filming and then editing and final version?
Oh gosh. And that is such a hard question because it is such an optimization problem. I mean, I talk about not working in a super technical field.
I just love the fact that you called that an optimization problem.
Oh my God.
I love it. It cracks me up. Love it so much.
And I think that I probably look at the problem in a different way, having a technical background.
Oh yeah, we would never call it that in the newsroom.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Oh no. So we have maybe 30 different locations that we want to fly to in the span of 6 months. And each of those locations will have a really good topic that we want to include in maybe 3 or 4 different episodes. And so we have a travel budget that we need to stick to. And when we go to these locations, we need to get everything we need for those 4 episodes so that we don't have to travel back there and spend money to haul all our stuff back there. And so we need to really have a good idea of everything we need at that location. And so sometimes that means shooting one segment for the first episode and the last segment for the last episode and trying to understand visually where that's going to fit in the story. And I mean, it's very chaotic and we don't always get it right, but it is kind of fun putting those puzzle pieces together and trying to optimize the problem.
I love it. It cracks me up. I'm sorry. I don't know why it cracks me up. It's just that doing the exact same thing for a news agency, which is what I've done for years, is hard. Of course, we were on a much shorter time scale, right? You know, the story breaks on Monday and you have to have your story by Monday. So there's less logistics. But, you know, when you're out, you go, we went to Alaska and we were there for 4 days. And it's you have to get everything you can get while you're there. You're not going back. So...
Absolutely. And we sort of have a different problem because we can't date our shows because our shows will rerun for the course of 2 years.
No.
So if there's anything that happens in the space industry in the next 2 years, we have to be very careful about how we talk about it. Or sometimes we just can't include it because if some scientist is going to be like, well, this is going to launch in March. And we're going to be like, well, our show is going to have aired 2 months after that, and that's not going to make sense when you're talking about March being in the future. It's just going to be very confusing. So, yeah, we have to think about those things also.
Oh, man. You're stressing me out just thinking about it.
No, it's fun stress. It's fun stress.
So, is your, on a daily basis, what's your average day like? Are you, if you're not on site, are you researching and planning, or how does your day work?
Exactly. So, I mean, this season has been so fast-paced because we were shooting more episodes than we did last season, which is a good thing. That means the network liked the show. But that means that I've been filming about probably 3 weeks out of the month. And so when, we're on site, we're filming all day. I'm doing interviews all day and shooting what we call stand-ups, where I'm just kind of memorizing what my script and trying to introduce the viewers to the show and what we're going to show that day. And then when I'm not in the field, yeah, I'm usually at the local Starbucks and trying to figure out what we need to put in future episodes and writing blogs and, you know, doing the social media thing.
Which is a whole job in itself.
Exactly. Oh my God. Yeah.
So how many episodes are going to be in this upcoming season? Or when is season 2 coming out? Or has it come out?
Yeah. Yes. So season 2 will air in September of this year, and it will have 17 episodes.
Wow. Stepping it up, huh?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Do you revisit stuff? I mean, like, things you've done the first season, like, that if something changes, like, you know, SpaceX does something new, do you plan on sort of revisiting the same idea with the latest and greatest?
Absolutely. I mean, we're going to have to if we want the show to last for more than a few years, because there's always stuff going on in the space industry. And companies like Northrop Grumman have their hands in so many different types of space-related projects that we're going to need to go back to the same people and say, you know, how are you contributing to this project? And how are you contributing to this project? And what's new on the James Webb Space Telescope? Just because they're these huge projects that so many people are working on, and it's changing every year.
What's been the feedback like from audience members?
The feedback has been overwhelmingly good. What I find funny is that in most locations, we replaced infomercials. And
that's a claim to fame right there.
Yeah, like, we've been outperforming the infomercials, which I think is a great sign for humanity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in that respect, the feedback has been great. And what also I think is really cool is that we got back our demographic information, and over 55% of our viewers have been female.
Woo-hoo!
Yes. You know, like, it's like, for a show based on a male-dominated field, and 55% are female. So I think that's really awesome.
Do you have the age range for that demographic?
Yeah, so we skewed a little bit older than we were shooting. We did really, really well in the 20 to 30-year-old age range, which is great. I mean, that's the, you know, young
God,
professional audience.
People would kill for that audience.
That. Yeah, no, I love that. But I think our goal for this year is to really focus on capturing the younger audience at the high school age and get them, you know, before they're choosing what major to major in college, so that we can maybe get more STEM majors out there.
What a perfect segue.
Yes. Well, I have one more question.
Go for it.
Actually, sorry, I ruined the segue.
You did ruin the segue.
Well, I just wanted to know, are there certain things that you are changing now to be able to skew your demographic a little bit younger, like the scripts or subject matter or what?
Absolutely. So I think the goal right now is to show off more younger students who are doing science and research on the screen. Because last year, you know, our goal or our strategy was to get the best of the best in the field. And obviously what that typically means is an older scientist or an expert who is talking on the screen, which is great. I mean, they have a lot of knowledge about the industry and about their project. But what we want to do this year is to show off younger students who are doing a lot of the same stuff, but maybe on a smaller scale. So, for example, this year we featured a high school team that had sent a CubeSat on the orbital science rocket that exploded last year.
Oh, right. Yeah,
remember
I remember
that. Students, yeah.
I know, right? So they were all excited about sending something into space, and it was on this rocket, and they literally went to Wallops to watch it launch, and it exploded off the launch pad. And so we went back to them, and it turns out that the company that they went through, NanoRax, is giving them a second chance to launch that CubeSat into space. So we wanted to show off their story about how, you know, they learned the hard way about how difficult
what space is really like.
Yeah, that space is hard, and that, you know, this wonderful company, NanoRax, is giving them a second chance to launch their CubeSat into space.
Well, so that now I'm going to segue. Can we segue, Mumu?
Yes, you may.
Okay, so you brought up STEM, and this is still related to the talking about the high school kids. You've done a lot of stuff when it comes to STEM, and obviously that's part of sort of what you're doing. I recently sort of wrote a blog post about what the definition of STEM is. What do you use as your definition, and what does it sort of mean to you as a concept?
Yeah, that's a very good and very complicated question.
It's a question, hard question, right? I mean, I'm struggling. I don't have an answer for
it. It's a very hard question. I know. And I think it's getting broader the more that people recognize it, because I think STEM should be more than more than just the majors and the careers of scientists and engineers. I think it's becoming increasingly important that the general public have an understanding of STEM and have this kind of what I call like STEM literacy, kind of like science literacy, but applying that to really all of these STEM fields. But I think for me, when I talk about STEM or when I think about STEM, I think about it in kind of two big buckets of science and engineering. And science is kind of what is, and engineering is what can be. So science is, you know, figuring out how the world works, and engineering is how we can use that knowledge to make the world better.
That's a great sort of definition or distinction. Much better than the one I tried to do a little while back. I was trying to define science and engineering, and it involved like dirt and oxygen, and it was just all over the place. But yeah. I like the way that you sort of framed it.
Yeah, it can definitely be a very complicated topic. And I think it's getting pretty fuzzy now because we hear about things like climate change and genetically modified foods and things that affect everybody, not just people that are working on an iPhone or are, you know, developing something in a lab. So we need to have kind of a broader definition or understanding of STEM so that everybody can feel like that is something that they can understand.
Well, I mean, it's a concept that Mumu and I have argued over, discussed, maybe not argue with, when we were sort of started this podcast. Like, what do we, you know, we want to, how do we sell it? Oh, it's like STEM topics. Okay, but it's not really, right? I mean, like, would you count yourself as a STEM person? You're not actually technically doing science and engineering, but you are interpreting and sharing and working with it. Just like I am now. Exactly. I mean, it's a weird.
And so I would.
Yeah.
I would count myself as a STEM person because I think that there's this new career that's kind of carving itself out within STEM, and that's science communication. And I think that people.
The much with a needed background window, in by the way.
Technology. Yeah, absolutely. And people are doing it in so many different ways. They're doing it with YouTube channels, they're doing it on various social media, they're doing it in science journalism. And so I think that I do consider myself as part of STEM just because I'm working in this area. And that's kind of, I guess, what I mean when I talk about making it a broader understanding of what STEM encompasses.
Do you think that we need more political leaders who have a STEM or science type background? Do you think that would help?
I think that having a STEM background for in Congress would be super helpful. I don't think that that is required or necessary to have an understanding of STEM or to be STEM literate, because there are plenty of people without a formal background in science or engineering who believe in climate change or believe in evolution. And so I think that more so we need people in Congress that are STEM literate. I think having a formal background in science and education would certainly help.
Do you think it's getting easier or harder to get people involved in this? I mean, we're talking about the topic is talked about all the time, right? It's like the buzzword that's dropped. But does that mean things are actually changing? Or do you see it firsthand? Do you notice? I mean, you've got a big audience, right?
Yeah, you know, and I think that it is changing. I keep hearing from people who work in film and TV that TV programming is getting smarter, that there's some, maybe a good analogy is that there's a bubble bursting in the reality TV market. There's just way too many reality TV shows, and that people are craving more educational programming. And so I think that there is movement toward more STEM literacy and people being more excited about science and technology. One really cool example is, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Facebook page, I Effing Love Science.
Yes, yes.
Way to censor yourself there, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. Got to be careful. But I mean, I love this Facebook page. It's very quick and funny and a kind of like a bite-sized information of science and technology. But if you look, that Facebook page is just as, or I think now it's more popular than the Facebook page for Madonna.
Wow. Which is
ridiculous because Madonna is Madonna.
No, well, there's that, and that other thing, like when, and I hate to bring this up because it annoys me, but the, you know, that whole thing with the dress and people seeing it blue and black and other people seeing it white and gold. And right. I was like, I said this to Mumu, and I was just excited that people were arguing over something that was scientifically debatable, right? And that you could talk exactly, about the science behind it, and then people wanted to know about the science behind it. And I was sitting there going, yes, this is great.
But, you know, it was also interesting that I spent forever trying to actually find a good scientific explanation that was clear and understandable. And so it was a really interesting story that came up.
I know. And I love that. I thought that was a great example of people who do study this type of thing in science and engineering, being able to use like their little superpowers to be able to explain to the public why everybody was going crazy.
If you had free reign or the ear of the president and and you wanted to sort of, jumpstart this whole STEM outreach and getting kids involved at an early age, what things would you want to do?
So I think we've heard a new acronym that's been thrown around, STEAM, where they're kind of infusing art in the middle of it. And that, I mean, I think it's getting a little cumbersome trying to include everything in there, but I think the idea behind it is really important. And so I think what I would tell him is that there's a creative side to STEM that is sorely needed in this field. And that's kind of like the missing link, I think, between these very sometimes complicated and complex STEM topics and the lay audience or the public being able to understand them. Because anything can be explained somewhat simply if you can be creative enough. And I think we need more creative minds, people who are great at art and who are great at writing and who are great at, you know, creating really wonderful videos, who are interested in STEM, to be able to kind of mend that gap and be able to help communicate all of these very important topics like climate change and vaccinations and genetically modified foods to the general public.
Doing all these things, seeing all these different projects, I know you focus on space, but what gets you excited? What have you seen that just gets you sort of really sort of amped up and looking forward to seeing what happens?
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. By far, it's the space tourism market, because space tourism is something that is very recent. I mean, these people like Elon Musk and Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos are doing things that only government agencies like China and Russia and the United States could afford to do just 15 years ago. So these are people that have made their billions through other means and are now investing that money into their childhood dreams. And so I'm really excited to see where that goes and how that benefits the general public, because they're creating these really awesome spacecraft to send not just astronauts, these elite few, into space, but a broader audience who maybe have a few tens of thousands of dollars on their hand, but
just you know, whatever, lying around.
Exactly. But even so, I mean, that's exciting. It's like more people going into space. And I think that is something that I will be keeping my close eye on in the future.
Oh, and are you opening your wallet? That's the real question. Is that the next thing on your list?
Yeah, I'm saving my pennies.
your next show sponsor will be Virgin Galactic. And you're like, yeah, I'll volunteer for that one. Thanks.
Yeah, I'll do that. I would absolutely do that.
If you could please relay to Fox for me that I would love a revival of the Magic School Bus.
Oh,
that
yes.
would be fantastic.
Yes. All right, I'll let them know.
Well, thank you, Emily, for joining us. This has been really fun and really interesting. You're not hiring by any chance, are you?
No, not yet. Okay. Not yet. Maybe in season 3.
I had to ask, right? but thanks for joining us. This has been fun.
Thanks for having me.
Like our show? Find us on iTunes or at scopepodcast.com. And follow us online on Facebook and Twitter at Scope Podcast. This is Mumu Shu
and Lindsay Claiborne.
Our theme music was composed by The Copycats. Thanks for listening.